Hello, everyone. It's the Vookcast, episode number 166. I'm Stephen. I'm hosting and stuff. I'm here with some good friends. One of them is Josh. What's up, Josh?
Good morrow, fair listeners.
And James, he's also my friend. How are things? How's the plum chicken?
Yeah, I'm great. The chicken was good too.
I'm glad. We'll jump straight in, because I figured that we've been playing a whole bunch of video games recently, and the news that's been happening over the past couple of weeks, it's been news, but not really stuff we can talk about interestingly, so we're just going to talk about a whole bunch of video games today. So, firstly, I've been playing Bayonetta, James has been playing Bayonetta, has Josh been playing Bayonetta?
I have not been playing Bayonetta. I still have the Wii U version, which I bought close to release, that I don't think I've actually opened.
Ooh, yeah, well, I mean...
Disgusting.
I can't make too much fun, because that was literally me until I got the Switch once, so... Yeah, but I did play them. Turns out both Bayonetta games are extremely good. Fancy that. Gosh, where do I start with this? James, did you want to start with Bayonetta? How would you... describe them? What would you like to say about them?
Well, they are very garish, over-the-top action games from the crazy mind that brought us Devil May Cry. They're just like, I don't know, I think they're just really good fun. They're not really pretentious. They're just, you know, I don't know how to describe it. I feel like I've described this game 3 times already on various podcasts. But yeah, like you're a witch who has weapons on both not only her hands but also her feet. Like, what's not to love?
Pretty much.
She's like a super sassy character, and I understand the character's probably not going to be for everyone. But the action is just so well choreographed and so well designed, and the set pieces are all pretty remarkable, very memorable. It's like Devil May Cry, I guess, except they couldn't make Devil May Cry anymore because they weren't Capcom anymore. And Bayonetta is almost like the female, I guess she probably is the female version of Dante, the closest thing you could get. Maybe. They should do a crossover, like Hercules and Xena.
Yes,
well, they were almost in Project X Zone 2 together, weren't they? But then Cameo wanted to do it himself, the first crossover between them.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Oh, yeah, of course they could have been. You're right.
Crazy.
Yeah, well. They're great, really great games. I don't know. I just think they're fun because they give you a lot of tools that are kind of overpowered, but that makes it super accessible. But there's still that kind of skill ceiling, I guess, that makes them fun to play over and over again to kind of perfect your rank or perfect your score.
Yeah, totally. Know? Like, I sort of, you know this, James, but not many people do. Like, I really, really enjoyed Metal Gear Rising, and I kind of a little bit enjoyed the Legend of Korra game that Platinum made, but not to the same degree, because that was clearly not a high-budget thing. It was kind of a bit basic. But this... I don't know why I hadn't played Bayonetta before. It's like, hey, these games that you really like, this was kind of the best one, and it's been out for years. Why? And I'd owned it like 3 times already, but for whatever reason, I never actually played it until the Switch version, and holy crap, they're really good. Like, as you were saying, James, the combat is really, I don't know, it feels, everything's ridiculously, I don't know if overpowered's the right word, but just kind of immensely spectacular, kind of, like, everything's massive, you're bashing things with giant, hairy demon fists and dragons and shit.
I think that, like, the thing with Bayonetta is, every game up until this point that's kind of like that, so Ninja Gaiden, all of them, God of War, Devil May Cry, they've all given you, like, a dodge, or a sidestep, or an evasion of some sort, but Bayonetta is, like, the first game I remember playing, where if you dodge something with the right amount of, like, finesse or precision, you would enter, like, a little, really small slow-mo period, which is they call witch time, and that to me is, like, it's super overpowered, like, it's ridiculous, like, you can literally just bait things into attacking and then activate witch time, but it also kind of makes the game, it kind of teaches you to dodge and evade way better than any of the other games do,
Yeah, totally. Like, if you can dodge early and you'll still dodge the attack, but if you leave it to the last second and really sort of learn exactly when, you know, the tells of character attacks and stuff like that, you can dodge at the last second and do a really big sort of combo back at them. It's, yeah, as you say, it really makes it, it sort of teaches you to learn how the game plays a bit more than, I don't know, at least a lot of the other similar action games that I've played.
Yeah, and I think there's similar in Metal Gear Rising as well. Like, the mechanics are really simple. You've just got a couple of attacks and a parry, but it manages to make a really deep system out of it, and it pretty much throws you in the deep end trying to learn your parries, but once you've got that down, you're pretty much set for the rest of the game.
Yeah, the thing I was kind of surprised by is how easy it was. Like, I had it in my mind that this was some ridiculously difficult Platinum Games action thing that would just kick your ass all the time. But yeah, with Witch Time, and all you have to do is really learn one or two sort of quick combos that do a bit of damage, and you could just sort of ride that combo and dodge all the way through the game, and it's not going to penalize you for that. You'll do pretty well. But it also has the breadth of skills that lets you experiment with different, you know, combining different attacks, or, like, you know, throwing an enemy up in the air and following up with different attacks. If even switching out different weapons for, you know, you can switch out weapons for the hands and the feet, and also get a chain chomp for some reason, and also a bunch of other Nintendo-y things, which were really weird. And I honestly didn't play around with them too much until the second game. I kind of went fairly vanilla through the first game, but when I was in the second one, I'm like, okay, I finished one of them, let's play around with some other stuff. And there was this kind of, it's like a whippy sword sort of thing, and it just made a really good sort of wide range attack, which was really awesome to just play around with, sort of combining that with the regular attacks. And yeah, it just sort of blew me away how much freedom it gives you to sort of create your own combos within, you know, all the different options of movements and weapons and stuff that you have to play with in the game.
And I think that's why they're critically, I don't, like, commercially they're not the hottest games, but critically, like, they're very popular, because I feel like anybody with any breadth of experience can play them and enjoy them. Like, some people, for example, I'm running back through the first game at the moment and trying to get platinum ranks for everything, and like Steve, you said you can rely on the same combo, but the way that the combo system works, you kind of can't if you're trying to go for the high ranks.
Yeah.
Like, you'll probably get silver, gold, some platinums, just relying on the same kind of tactics. But platinum and pure platinum runs, they really require you to change up your approach. And that combo system is really what is different from between when you compare Bayonetta 1 and Bayonetta 2. Like, there's a very stark difference in the combo systems that kind of leads a lot of people to say that Bayonetta 2 is more casually orientated than the first game.
Yeah, I did see a lot of that on forums as I was looking after the review period, and I didn't really notice it as I was playing, but yeah, once they pointed it out, it's like, yeah, there's the whole Umbran Climax that's part of your regular combos in Bayonetta 2, and that really, I don't know, makes things a fair bit easier to chain together, and I don't know if they change too much else of it, but yeah, I kind of see where they're coming from.
I think with Bayonetta 2, it's more, so in Bayonetta 1, you've got to kind of vary your approach, like kicks, punches, guns, and then techniques or whatever.
Mm.
You've got to, like, vary them up. Kind of like Devil May Cry. You know how you do the same thing over and over in Devil May Cry? You never really go above a, you know, B-rank combo or A-rank combo or something?
Yeah, it sort of penalises you for using the same stuff over and over.
Yeah, and even, I think, maybe Beautiful Joe might have been a bit like that. I can't remember. It's a very, like, Kamiya thing to do, besides abuse people on Twitter. But, like, I don't know, it's hard to explain. Like, so with Bayonetta 2, the combo system kind of shifts more towards, if you're going to, the more damage you do in the shortest amount of time, the higher your score will be. Whereas Bayonetta 1 kind of encourages the changing up the, you know, your weapons and all of that, to keep that kind of, I guess, style going. Mm. Whereas in Bayonetta 2, you can kind of spam chainsaws and Umbran Climax and all of that effectively and still get pretty high ranks. Like, I would guarantee most people who play Bayonetta 2 would have a higher overall end of story rank than if they were playing Bayonetta 1.
You are 100% correct. I think I was basically averaged stone until I got to the end of the first game, and I was starting to get sort of silvers and bronzes and stuff, but yeah, in Bayonetta 2, probably it helped that I'd played the first one immediately, like, the day before, but, like,
yeah,
I was
getting
silvers
probably
and gold
also,
the whole time.
Your muscle memory probably was a bit more developed, too.
Yeah.
But I just think they're both great games. Like, I think they're both amazing, but that kind of fine-tuning has kind of lost a little bit of the depth of 2. And I didn't have that opinion when 2 first came out. I kind of only realised this going back to Bayonetta 1 this time around. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah.
Fantastic games, though.
I can't believe I'd put it off so long. Like, it kind of reminded me in how massive in scale a lot of these levels and enemies, and especially the bosses are, kind of gave me vibes of God of War, but I enjoyed the gameplay, like the actual combat, a lot more than any God of War that I played. It's sort of, instead of being, I don't know, Kratos is kind of lumbering and slow. He's like big and chunky, but it's not as exciting. Whereas Bayonetta, you're dodging, you're dancing around and shooting guns, like non-stop action. And for that reason, I couldn't stop playing it. I pretty much broke my hands playing 2 games in about 5 days, but it was so much fun.
Yeah, it reminds me of when I played Rising.
Oh, yes.
God, Rising is so good.
And I did all the bosses without getting damaged on Revengeance difficulty, and I remember I had to, like, actually take a break from games for a month because my hand was Devil May Cry, the reboot, and then that came out close to each other, so I was kind of fucked. Like, it was pretty bad. And that's, like, the thing about these, like, action games, like Platinum games, is they've got that kind of depth to give you those challenges. Like, to get a pure Platinum on a boss in Bayonetta 1, you've got to finish it without getting hit. And that can be really intense, but it's doable.
Yeah.
And especially, like, running through it once, you will be shit. And that's okay. Like, that's the point. Like, you're meant to run through it again after you've unlocked everything and, like, absolutely master it. And I love that you can. Like, it gives you all of the tools and all of the abilities to do that.
Yeah, it really gives you that sense of progression. Like, the stuff that you sort of go back and play early levels again and you just, these things that you kind of were very sort of fumbling about, getting hit by stuff. You come back to it, it's like, oh, I know the timing of these attacks. I can dodge them effectively, and I know some combos to go straight back at them. And it's just, yeah, you feel like you're a god because you just, all this stuff that used to give you so much trouble, you just roll through. It's so fun. Yeah, so much fun.
Yeah, like when you're going up against the bosses in Rising and you're just parrying all their attacks in rhythm and you're just flicking the analog stick up, mashing the buttons, and you're just seeing Raiden, like, parrying all these moves with his sword and everything looks so cool and you're in control of it, and it's when you realize that, it's like, whoa, this is really cool, I'm awesome.
For that,
yeah,
exact,
like, once
reason,
you get into that flow and that, you know, it's just really sublime is probably the best word to describe it. Just amazing that you started off getting hit by, like, the first enemy you encounter, like, 10 times, but now you're freaking parrying every single attack they throw at you or dodging every single attack they throw at you. So
yeah, like, if you enjoyed Revengeance, Josh, please play Bayonetta. Like, you're exactly the same as I was a month ago.
I don't know why I haven't.
It has amiibos.
Oh, yes, it does have amiibo support. It's not terribly exciting, but it's there.
Why else would you buy a game, really?
Not Serial, though.
Yeah. Oh, quick review on Serial. How was it?
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's really sweet, but yeah, it's nice.
Cool. And that was our review of Serial.
Amazing.
Thank you, Josh.
10 out of 10. Woody.
So you have been reviewing some other non-edible things. I had a quick peek at your Night in the Woods review, and I'm extremely intrigued. Give us a little bit of a lowdown. What's Night in the Woods, and why is it so incredible?
So it's sort of like an adventure game mixed with a platformer game. It's sort of, you go through the day in a life of May, who's a college dropout. She's just come back to her small town that she grew up in, and she's trying to fit back in and find her place in the world. So you journey around the town, you climb up poles, sort of jump around buildings, finding people to talk to, and you just sort of live in the town for a few days. And slowly, May starts forming bonds with her old friends and working out her issues and helping other people come to terms with everything that's going wrong in their life. And it just gets really heavy, but at the same time, it's really comforting about all these dark themes. And it's just really nice to play. Like, it's got this depth to it that I don't normally find in a lot of game stories.
I did find, like, there was one term that you used in the review, comforting melancholy. I'm like, man,
I want this. I'm so proud of that. It just, like, totally captures that those two words. Yeah, it just gets everything about the game.
Yeah, I appreciated sort of you got most of the way through the review without talking about gameplay as such. It seems like it's fairly heavily sort of like a narrative-based game rather than any sort of traditional video game as such, but would you say that it's sort of something that's told best by being in the form of a video game? Do you think it would be as effective in like a film or book or something like that?
No, I think it definitely benefits from the interactivity because you're sort of choosing what you do in your time in the town. So there's points where you have to choose who you want to spend time with, kind of like Persona. And there's all these hidden stories that you might not actually even find. So you've got to go out of your way to sort of invest in these characters. And then by their stories gradually build up. And then by the end of the game, they reach these really emotional conclusions. And I don't think it would have the same impact if you weren't consciously choosing to do all this stuff.
Yeah, I guess if you're choosing one, that means that you can't, you know, you have to choose one over another. And I guess that adds extra weight to the story that you unfold when you spend time with that character, kind of Persona-ish, as you say. That's enough to get me intrigued.
Yeah. It's pretty, like, Persona is a really good comparison. It's like if you took all the game bits out of Persona, that's pretty much Night in the Woods. But it's also a bit more involved in sort of roaming around the locations in the game. It's not just picking them from a menu, and they're not sort of hollow, I guess, like they can be in Persona, but they're sort of just places for you to go meet people. But the town is almost a character in itself, in the way that you have to explore it and you find all these hidden things inside it, and you can interact with pretty much everything in the environment, and May will have something to say about it, and she might start reflecting on how the town used to be in years gone by, or what she thinks of the changes and all that sort of thing. And so, it's a bit more involved.
It just sounds so, so very me. I'm going to buy this game after the podcast, I think.
I haven't seen much on it, but like, is the fact that they're animals played completely straight, or?
Oh yeah,
because I haven't seen anything like beyond screenshots.
Yeah, I don't think that's a good point. The fact that they're animals at all, like they just play it totally straight as if they're people. It is pretty great.
Right.
Cool. Any more Night in the Woods thoughts? Really intrigued.
I just want to play it, and I don't know what I want to play it on. That's the real... I kind of get this decision inertia, and then I just don't decide anything, and then that's it. I don't play it. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, did you play it on Switch, Josh, or, like, Xbox or PS4?
No, it was on the Switch, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
And no, like, performance issues or anything for being on the Switch, as far as you could see?
There's a couple of pretty long loading times, but from what I can tell, that's consistent across everything.
Right. Cool.
Fair enough. Cool. Well, you mentioned the word hollow, so now I want to talk to James about the game Hollow. I've watched... You linked a video in the chat before this podcast, so I gave that a bit of a look, and... For some reason, I was thinking it would be, I don't know, a 2D side-scroller, because Hollow made me think Hollow Knight for some reason, but it's really not that. Like, it's a 3D...
That poor game has a branding problem.
Yes. What is it? It's like a horror sort of game in, like...
Yeah, so I think the only reason I kind of paid attention to Hollow was because it was a game... I think Vooks published an article... last year sometime, like early last year, about this being one of the first R-rated games on the Switch. And I was like, ooh.
Okay.
And then...
I do like
it's
violence.
It's a horror game. It was set in space. It's a first-person game. Yeah. And I was like, cool, this has my interest. I think it's a Switch exclusive. I could be wrong. Maybe it's on PC as well. It's built on Unreal Engine, so easily ported over. You play as, like, an unnamed pilot who's on, I think it's a space station orbiting Jupiter or something. And as you go deeper into the space station, stuff is wrong and bad.
Cool.
The story's, like, definitely not going to win awards or anything. It's pretty straightforward horror stuff. The problem with horror is the more you kind of can, like, watch, play, see, the less interesting it gets.
Yeah, I guess when you see the tropes, you see them for the tropes that they are sometimes.
Yeah, and Hollow is trying a little bit too hard, I feel. It wears its budget on its sleeve, so like it's a lot of reused environments. It's a lot of... It's got this horrible... I don't really know why they've done... Well, I do know why they've done it. It's got this really horrible, like, lo-fi kind of smudginess over the top of the visuals to make it look like you're viewing it through, like, a really bad camera, which gives it that kind of Blair Witch atmosphere, I guess. But it's a bit... Because the game is pretty rough, it does just come across as just looking cheap, if that makes sense.
Yeah, the little bit that I saw, like, I could see the general... aesthetic, like there were CRT screens all over the place that kind of looked like almost alien, sort of that kind of retro futurist sort of era. And I guess in that way, looking through a crappy video camera, I guess sort of fits into that aesthetic as ill thought out as that might end up being.
I just think like Resident Evil 7, and I know it's probably stupid to compare a game like that to a Switch game, but that kind of did the lo-fi look a little bit more. A little bit better than this is. But I reckon I'm about halfway, three quarters of the way through it. It's fairly short. I really thought it was going to go the Event Horizon route. I don't know if you guys have seen that movie, but it's a really good horror movie. That
scared the crap out of me as a kid, and I don't think I've watched it since.
Yeah, like just a really weird kind of mixes that kind of religious kind of themes of heaven and hell and shit with sci-fi that you don't see much very often. And I, the one thing I do want to, like, mention is, like, I think that this could have easily been a game, like, I played a game called Narcosis a few months ago on Xbox, and that was very much just walk through an area and scary shit happens. Yeah. Whereas this, like, has guns and combat, and I really want to kind of commend the developer for not doing the lazy thing and just being like, oh, it's just, you know, scary shit happens. Like, there's actually guns and enemies and stuff.
Yeah, I think horror games, a lot of them fall into that, like a spooky roller coaster ride where you just go forward, like bad
walking,
things happen.
Like, they call them walking sims, but a horror one is like...
Scary walking
like, you know, when you walk through those shitty rides at the Royal Show and stuff and things jump at you.
That's what I was thinking of.
It's scary for, like, the first 3 minutes, then you realize it's not.
Nothing can do anything to you.
Yeah, I guess like, it's just bit hard because it's hard to balance up. When you've got combat, you've got to make your players powerful enough to get through, while also weak enough and feeling threatened enough for it to actually be a horror experience. So I think it is a bit easier to take the other route, but it's more satisfying if they can get the payoff from the harder work.
And I think that's the problem with Hollow as well, is I found myself with no ammo quite a bit. And because the game doesn't have... It has a map, but it's not particularly useful. And... It just doesn't, like, kind of... You know how Resident Evil had, like, items would shine at you a little bit? Or there'd be some, like, really subtle way for you to tell where an item is?
Yeah.
Hollow doesn't really have that, so I feel like I've probably missed a lot of ammo.
So it's stuff that would kind of just blend into the background a bit.
Yeah, and even, like, I didn't realize there were save points until the fourth save point in the game.
Wow.
Because the computers and stuff don't really have that visual landmarking that makes you realize they're for save points. If that makes sense.
Yeah, so it doesn't indicate that it's anything more than a piece of background sort of set dressing.
Yeah, and that's the problem. It's a bit busy and claustrophobic, and it becomes... All the things that they've done to make it creepy and scary become more annoying. And the most questionable thing about it, and this is obviously not... I don't know if everybody's going to agree with me, but a lot of the enemies are dead, naked women, and there's a lot of naked, dead women everywhere... Like,
curious choice.
Like, I get it, but then it kind of becomes borderline just distasteful, gratuitous for the sake of it.
Weird. I didn't watch clearly enough into it to see that, but let's...
Did you get to the first enemy in the video?
I skipped around a little bit, I'll admit.
Okay.
Yeah, mainly just saw lots of very dark hallways with a flashlight and then a computer unlock screen or something.
When you get to the first enemy and, like, she appears, it's like this kind of weird, gross H.R. Giger-esque mix of robot and human. And it was kind of gross, and I was like, ew. Like, naked woman chasing me with robot arms. But... Or legs. And then they kind of kept reusing that kind of naked woman enemy type quite a bit, and that's the budget showing too, I'm sure. But maybe just chuck in a few clothed people to break it up a bit.
Just like some people have clothes in space, I'm sure. They'll find them somewhere.
Like, I'm sure not everybody on this freaking mining station was working naked. Like,
just like maybe they were, who knows, with their mining
tools.
They
just all got caught up in the apocalypse during Pants Off Friday.
Maybe yes. Hugh Hefner is the boss and it's actually a space Playboy mansion. I don't know.
Well, you are only 75% through, so you never know.
Yes, who knows where it could go. We all saw how The Conduit 2 ended. No one saw that coming. So, let's see how this goes. I don't know. It's a pretty good first effort, for sure. And like I said, I really commend them for not just making it a game where you walk through a hallway and scary stuff happens. But it is a little bit rough. And the violence isn't as impactful as I think they thought it was. Especially the violence against women.
Specifically. Cool. Yeah. Payday 2 is pretty violent. Josh likes Payday 2.
Yeah, speaking of rough R-rated games.
Yeah, actually, good point. So there's been a lot of interesting things happening with Payday 2 and content that is in it and not in it and prices and, yeah, it's kind of all over the place. What's going on, Josh? Please tell us.
So basically, going into the Switch version, I was really worried because the console versions of Payday 2, first there was the PS3 and 360 versions, which didn't get pretty much any of the extra content. They were broken, didn't get updates, they were just kind of left for dead. Then there was the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One versions that started off really weak, started to get updates, but not as frequently as PC. Mm-hmm. And they've almost caught up now, but it took a really long time. So I was really worried that the Switch would kind of be in the same boat. And being not as powerful as a PS4 and Xbox One, I thought maybe it would be impacted even more. Because Payday 2 on PC has had so many content updates, so much DLC, so much added to it. I think it came out in 2013. And they just keep getting their contract in this game extended because they just keep making so much money from this DLC. So it's still getting content 5 years later. The Switch version doesn't have all of that. It has about 2 or 3 years of content still. So there's still a lot there, but it's missing a few heists, a few characters, some quality of life fixes. And so it is behind all the other current versions. So, yeah, that's what's got people riled up, because it's not on par feature-wise with the others. It's behind the PS4 and Xbox One versions, which are themselves behind the PC version.
Interesting. I do wonder how much effort it must take to keep so many of these different versions relatively up to date, because you'd have to, I know, some stuff might be possible on PC that's not possible on, like, PS4 and Xbox, and you know, even there, you might have stuff that's not going to be doable on Switch, given the power disparity. There's so much going into this, but I don't know, it's extremely expensive on Switch.
On the PC, they kind of take like an agile approach, as we call it in the business.
We do.
They're just kind of chucking out updates all the time. Like, it's pretty much like every week there's a new update. They'll either add things, change things, tweak things, and the consoles don't really allow that sort of process.
Yeah,
you've
there's
got to
a lot
go through
more,
so much approval.
Exactly, yeah, a lot more sign-off.
Yeah. So it's a lot harder to adapt their development model to the consoles. And I think they're also a pretty small developer as well. And they're working on a really, really old engine. So I can kind of understand it a bit, but it is still frustrating when they're charging full price for this game that is behind the other versions. But that being said, there is
really
still a lot in
on
here.
Switch. Like, comparatively more expensive, I think. I don't know how much it is on the other consoles, but I know
I'm
used
PC,
to seeing it in Steam
free,
years ago for
like,
nothing.
It's
yeah.
on sale all the time. Yeah, but like there is still a lot here. There's dozens of heists that are mostly unique from each other. Like you've got bank heists, casino heists, like you'll attack military bases, armored transports, all this kind of stuff. And it is a really good game, But, yeah, it's just the missing content and some of the performance issues that it's got on the Switch are just a bit irritating.
It's a shame. I imagine it doesn't have, like, local multiplayer or anything. It's probably going to be, you know, at least multiple systems.
It actually does. Not split screen, but it's got, it's got local wireless, but not split screen.
Okay. Well, that's, yeah, kind of expected. It seems like it's pushing it hard enough. And I imagine sharing, especially on a, like, tablet docked, or not docked mode, I'm like tabletop mode, that'd be a bit of a mess to do in split screen when it's that sort
yeah
of complex.
And it's also got like a whole metagame component to it as well. Like, you've got skill trees, you've got perk decks that you can equip,
okay,
weapons you can customize, and all your characters you can get, you can like customize them with their own masks. They're sort of like their signature iconography kind of thing, so you can unlock all these different masks during the game and customize them how you want and all that sort of thing. So, like, it's a really deep game when you get into it. There's a lot of systems at play. And, like, I'll go on and on and on about how much I love playing the game. But it's just not on par with the others. And so someone like me who loves the game on PC, I'm okay putting up with the quirks, I guess you'd say, of this version just to get it portable and playable on the go. Mm. Like, I was getting stuck into all these heists on the bus to and from work. And, that, like, I just love doing that. It's so cool.
Actually, sort of on that, does it have much to do when you're not with other people, either online or sort of local wireless? Is there much of a single player component that you could conceivably play on the bus, I guess?
Yeah, so you can do everything by yourself. It's okay. Just not as easy, I guess. Like, when you've got I was playing with someone today, and you can split up some of the objectives in a heist. So at one point in one of the heists we were doing, we had to find some explosives that had been hidden for us in this military base, and they're hidden all over the place. So we split up. One of us took one end, one of us took the other. We found it all, come together, and then defended ourselves while one of us was setting up the traps. Then we're breaking through all these military vaults, and we're kind of able to help each other out. But if you're playing by yourself, it's a lot more tedious. Like, some of the heists give you lots of things you've got to do, and you've got to do it all by yourself. And you do have bots that will help you take on enemies, but the Switch doesn't have the update that made them more useful in terms of objectives. So you have to carry all the loot yourself. If there's guards spotting you from the other side of the room, you don't have anyone having your back. It's a bit more tedious, but it's still enjoyable. Like, most of my hundreds of hours that I put into the PC version were played solo. So
okay.
It's doable. It's just not as cool as playing with your friends, because like, you feel like a total badass when you all just come rocking up with all your gear and all your skills, and you just rock up into a bank, take everyone hostage, like bust open the vault, and you're all running around chucking loot around while the police are chasing you, and it's really cool.
Nice. Well, I wish it was cheaper. I'm not gonna say I'll buy it, because man, that's an expensive game, but
yeah,
I'm curious one day. It sounds like a fun thing if I can grab some friends and play it all together.
Zelda and Mario cost less. I just find that a bit weird when you think about it.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure what's up with the price. Like, it does have lots of stuff in it, but it's best, like, when it's behind the other versions, and I think those other versions are also a bit cheaper. It's not great.
Cool. But the game's great, and that's the main thing, I guess. And lastly, I figure we'll have a quick chat about Dandara. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but hopefully one of my good friends will know. Have you both been playing it? I know James has.
I definitely have. 100%.
I don't think I've even heard of it before now.
Right.
I'll just smile and nod.
It actually piqued my interest because I actually got an email from Xbox about it, like a media one, saying this is out on the service soon, and it was like a Metroid-esque, described as being Metroid-esque, but with a twist, and all the art was it's a very odd, abstract, almost like a Salvador Dali painting come to life kind of art style.
Okay.
And that kind of caught my eye, and then I started playing it. And the most,
well, looking at the
same
page now, and there's like a character leaping around the store page. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And that's the thing that kind of took me by surprise. I was like, I just bought it because I thought, oh, this is going to be a cool Metroid-y kind of game. And then I played it, and I was like, okay, like, move. And then she didn't move, and I was like, what? And then The reason she doesn't move is the only way to move in this game is to, like, aim to an area like the roof or the floor, and you kind of jump. So you can only jump from, like, surface to surface, which sounds kind of horrible, but I trust you me, it's not.
Okay.
That being said, the review on Vox, which I did not write, kind of didn't enjoy it as much as I did. but I think it's really cool that you've got this really weird little game with all these kind of Metroid stylings to it that is able to somehow be interesting and fun and intense, despite the fact you can't walk or run in it. Like, it's literally just jumping from surface to surface.
Yeah, I can't...
Is there a story reason for that, or is it just a unique mechanic?
The world is weird, so, like, it's... I couldn't even really tell you what the story is, but okay. The way that your characters move and the way that all the characters behave, there's definitely... like, the character you play as Dendara, she's some kind of god that's been, like, reawakened to kind of save the world from something bad. And I don't think there is a particular reason why she can only jump. I think it's something to do with, like, so the only areas you can jump in the game are covered in salt, which is what they call the, I don't know, the main essence of life or whatever. So right. She can only jump on areas that are white in the section. So I'm assuming maybe because she's a god, she can only stand in the salt. I don't know. The story definitely was not the highlight for me.
kind of abstract like the rest of it, I guess.
It's just, yeah, and it, like, it kind of, it's, you don't realise how not being able to run and walk opens up the kind of combat and the puzzle elements to this kind of new degree of, like, you kind of think about things differently when you're playing a game like this. As an example, like, because you can't touch the floor if they don't want you to, like, if there's no salt on it, there's, like, three little cubes in the middle of the screen, and that you can jump to them, but then when you charge, because you can only attack with a charge cannon, well, the equivalent of a charge cannon, so you've got to charge up your attacks before they can be, like,
right,
yeah, shot. And the inertia of that, like, pushes your character across the platform sometimes, or might flip like an area, or it's, you've got to kind of think about that kind of stuff, the physics of that, rather than just jumping or running across.
Yeah, it sounds really cool.
Yeah, it's really, like, I'm really surprised that somebody didn't like it. but who knows? I mean, we're all different.
We have a diverse set of voices here at Vox.
Yeah, and there's, like, some really cool boss battles. Like, the boss battle, there's a boss battle with a weird head that looks like Bison from Street Fighter, and that has two phases. And the first phase is you're literally in a box, so you can only really jump diagonally from one area to another in, like, a diamond shape. So and the boss's attacks and moves are kind of built around that.
Okay.
And then, like, the walls, like, explode, and then this thing, he's, like, flying back, and it turns into almost like a Gradius or Parodius kind of setup, where you're moving, you're trying to jump desperately between platforms as he attacks you. And it's just really, I don't know, it's really unique. Like, the music is really odd, but really out there. Because this game has a lot of ties to... apparently, Dendara, as a character, is based on, like, a Brazilian or Afro-Brazilian woman who actually was, like, a warrior and who committed suicide because she didn't want to become a slave. Okay. Back in the... like, I think it was, like, the 1600s or something. Like, it's actually a real person. But not much is known about her. She kind of was the, like... This woman was meant to be, the like, one of the four... like, the forebearers of the capoeira fighting style. Like, she was actually a real person. And it's just so fascinating that games find these weird little stories to kind of build a game around. And I don't know how, like, respectful or, like, how true to form this game is to her real story. But the game itself is just amazing. It's just a really, really interesting, different kind of game.
Yeah,
I've just never played anything like it. Do you know what I mean? Like, yes, the progression is kind of Metroid-esque. Not as, like, you know, not a lot of backtracking unless you really want to collect everything. But just, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I think people shouldn't write it off just because I did know it used to be a mobile game.
Oh, okay.
Which is so confusing, like, I don't know how it would have worked on a mobile. But I guess maybe some people prefer the... I think the touch controls might have made it a bit more easy, but I've handled fine with the control stick. But it's very unforgiving, I should probably mention. And it's got that kind of Dark Souls thing where you kill something, they drop currency. If you die, that currency is left behind.
Right.
Yeah. And then you've got to get back to it, otherwise you die. Kind of like Shovel Knight as well. Mm. But the game uses that as a story kind of thing too. So you might find floating bodies. It's kind of like your own. But when you pick up Dandara's body after you've died, it says she died because of injuries or whatever. Because you did. That's how you died in the game. But then other characters, you'll pick up their body and they're in a library or something. And then you pick up their body and it says they died of depression or something. So it kind of has that kind of subtle underlying kind of... storytelling as well.
Yeah, just kind of like, I don't know, give you just enough information about that corpse.
Literally just one, literally person in a room with one word, and that kind of gives you an idea of how they lived. Do you know what I mean? It's just a weird game. If I had any recommendations to people, I'd say go listen to the soundtrack if you can. You'll see how kind of unique and weird it is, and that might make you even want to play it.
Cool. I just didn't quite know. I remember you told me about the the whole jumping between surfaces, and then I think at a later stage I read somewhere that it was kind of Metroidvania-esque, and I had no idea how those ideas would reconcile, but apparently they do, at least for James, so that's nice.
It's unique. It's a setting and a premise and a concept that hasn't really been done before, and I think that's fantastic.
Cool. Well, this has been a fantastic episode of the Bookcast, I think. So, if you want to read more about... It's definitely... if you want to read more about any of these games, we have a whole bunch of written reviews up on the site for each of them, and reviews for a whole bunch of other stuff, news, bargain guides, all the usual sort of Nintendo-y stuff at vooks.net. That's books, but with a V. I have been Stephen. You can find me on Twitter and all the social bits and pieces at Stephen Impson. Where can we find you, Josh?
I am Mario Bones at Twitter, Mario_Bones. Don't forget the second underscore. And I'm also at monamiibo.com.
Cool, cool. And James, where do you hang out?
Just Twitter. And it's at Jam, so ATJAMZ.
Cool, cool. Follow us all. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Sorry it took, I think it was roughly 3 weeks since the last one. I kind of lost track. Sorry about that. We're back. We'll jump back on the train. Until next time, hope you have a good video game time and a good time in general, I guess. Catch you later.
Bye.